Miami Herald News provided by Lincoln, featuring a panoramic retractable roof on the 2013 Lincoln MKZ that opens up to over 15 square feet of skylight. Introducing the Lincoln Motor Company. More at Lincoln.com.
And it is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman, on this Tuesday afternoon. Well, today we visit with Rebecca Costa. She's a sociobiologist and a former Silicon Valley pioneer. She's also a radio talk host, and she's written the book, The Watchman's Rattle, Thinking Our Way Out of Extinction. And she joins us from Carmel, California. Welcome to you, Rebecca. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Describe the gridlock, which you say precedes the inevitable collapse in
the book. Well, it's pretty obvious if we look at every country around the globe that they're all suffering from the same gridlock and the same list of dangerous problems that they're trying to face. And it doesn't matter if we're talking about jobs creation, illegal immigration, wild swings in financial markets, escalating debt, energy, terrorism, climate change, the list of dangerous problems that leaders are trying to deal with and the person on the street is trying to figure out are all the same. So you would think that some light bulb would go off at some point in time and we'd realize that these are not political and economic problems because everybody's got different economic and political systems. So if they were, then why would they have the same problem? So just pure logic would tell us that we've got something going on a species-wide basis. And this is why we're struggling. We're struggling because we describe everything as an economic or political problem, and so we only pursue those remedies. And this is what's gotten us into the trouble we're in today.
So you're saying that there's actually a genetic explanation for our inability to cope with our current problems and catastrophes, both the past catastrophes and the impending ones?
Absolutely. We can look back at the Mayan civilization, which was around for 3,000 years, the Romans, the Khmer, the great Egyptian empires, and we can see that long before the event that shoved these civilizations off the cliff, because I'm not interested in that cataclysmic event that shoved them off the cliff, it's what's interesting to us and what we ought to be paying attention to is that long, slow drive toward the cliff and why we don't turn the steering wheel. Take the Mayans, for example. For 3,000 years, they knew they had a tenuous relationship with rainfall. That wasn't anything new. And that's very similar to our current fiscal cliff. It's not as though the fiscal cliff just showed up one week. We've had plenty of time. We knew where we were headed. One of the great advantages that humans have evolved over millions of years is our ability to preview by doing thought experiments and see the consequences of our actions and then to take some action in the present to avoid a negative outcome, and yet we've squandered that ability.
So how do we expand our cognitive capacity to keep pace with the complexities?
Well, one way to look at evolution and why it presents such a problem and why it's responsible for these problems that are as complex as those that physicists have to deal with on a day in and day out basis is to think of our situation as two clocks. One clock, every time the hand moves, it's the clock of evolution. Millions of years go by and we develop opposable thumbs, we stand upright, or we develop the frontal cortex, which took 3-4 million years to evolve. It's the CEO of our brain, and it's the one that uses logic to make decisions. And then the other clock, every time the hand moves, it's a picosecond, and we have 200,000 apps that can fit on your cell phone or a new smartphone, a new regulation, a new law, a new derivative on Wall Street that even the people running the largest pension funds can't figure out, but they have to buy. They have to try to buy and invest in. And so we can see that complexity is a runaway train, and eventually it exceeds the cognitive capabilities that you and I have, people walking the street have, and even our leaders have. There, you know, we can argue whether those two clocks meet, today or 50 years from now, but at some point our cognitive capabilities are outstripped by the complexity of the problems that we have to solve in order to survive.
Rebecca Costa, just what is a sociobiologist?
Well, a sociobiologist looks toward our genetic inheritance to explain our behaviors, particularly when human behavior becomes irrational or can't be explained by logical means. We can see now that the problems that we're dealing with have been around for many, many generations. And the fact is that we've had solutions to them. We have technology. And a lot of people are walking around the street today scratching their head and saying, well, why aren't we on top of these problems? Why aren't we fixing them? Why aren't we making progress anymore? Why do we just seem to be stuck on kicking the can down the road and short-term mitigations? And it turns out there are genetic reasons that we behave in this way.
So what are the deconstructionist problem-solving techniques that we're using ineffectively?
Well, one definition of complexity is that there are more wrong choices than there are right choices. I love that definition because it's easy to understand. So in a complex environment, the odds are against you, no matter how much due diligence you do, of picking the right solution. And they're getting worse every day because the number of wrong solutions are exponentiating. So one way to look at current humankind is that we're facing a high failure rate environment, not just as a society, not just as a nation, but as individuals. You can talk to anybody today who's trying to retire and figure out where they should invest their money or what health care plan they ought to sign up for. Just talk to them about anything, even a light lighting up on the dashboard of your car. You don't know if you should take it in for service or not. Things are so much more complicated than we've been designed by nature to deal with. And so one of the problems that we have is that we're struggling right now in a high failure rate environment. But one of the wonderful things about being a human today in 2012 is that we have models for success in high failure rate environments. Venture capital happens to be one of them.
Yes, give us a further example of how this applies to a current problem, be it to venture capitalism or, say, global warming. How could it be addressed differently and along with the premise of your book?
Well, if that's only one solution, and there are many solutions presented in the book, because I don't like books that are all about doomsday and we're all going to come to an end and there's nothing we can do about it. Certainly, we have technology and we have more knowledge than at any other time in human history. And it is our responsibility to use that now to not go the way of earlier civilizations, which I describe in the first third of the book. We now know that there are very early symptoms. We become gridlocked. We become confused about what are facts and what are beliefs. And then public policy becomes irrational and we fall off of a cliff. If we know the problem is advancing complexity and that eventually that outstrips the capabilities that we've evolved thus far, then we can use examples like venture capital, where for every 100 companies they invest in, they know no matter how much due diligence they do, maybe only 10 or 15 are going to succeed, whereas 80, 90% of them are going to fail, but the successes will far dwarf the failures. So let's take an example like the Gulf oil spill. Suddenly we have a mission-critical, time-sensitive problem. So we go in and we decide that we're going to drop a concrete box on the hole, and then we wait another 30 days. That didn't work. And then we decide we're going to drill from the side. We wait another 30 days. That doesn't work. And then we use static kill, and that, 30 days later, that seemed to work. Contrast that against the rescue of the Chilean miners, another mission-critical, time-sensitive, potentially catastrophic problem that you've got to jump on immediately. How can you use the venture capital approach? They went after those miners with 16 rescue plans, and 16 eventually proved that they couldn't work, and it went down to 15, 14, 13. And even when they rescued every single miner, they were still pursuing three or four rescue plans in tandem because they knew there was no way to be efficient. There was no way to eliminate waste in a situation like that.
You say we've developed mitigation strategies for avoiding failure. What are they, and so how do they work exactly?
Well, as an example, venture capital, mitigation is not a bad idea, but let's remember, it only buys you time to put in a permanent solution. We've gotten so addicted to mitigations like tax refunds or stimulus packages or even the upcoming fiscal cliff. All that's on the table are mitigations. There's no real permanent solutions. And a society that becomes a junkie for mitigations is a society that is sentencing itself to collapse. You must use that time to effect a permanent solution. And if you look at every major social problem we have today, none of them have been solved for generations and generations. We've allowed them to exponentiate, and now we're passing off a world that is significantly more dangerous and troubled than the one we inherited.
But isn't our republic actually founded on the principle of compromise?
It isn't. This isn't
or mitigation.
A matter of really compromise, so much as it is a confusion in society. You know, we're at that second stage. The first stage is gridlock. This is always the first stage, the earliest stage, that a society is in trouble, or even an organization is in trouble. They know what their most dangerous problems are, and they can't get on top of them, compromise or not. The second symptom, which is more troubling, is there's a confusion about empirical facts and unproven beliefs. We become susceptible to false prophets, people who give opinions as though they're based on empirical facts. And the third most dangerous symptom is that then public policy is forged on the basis of unproven beliefs. I think that we are at that second stage right now. Whether civilization will grab, you know, some kind of a lifeline and save itself, you know, it's a page turner. We've got to do something, and we've got to do it soon.
We're speaking with Rebecca Costa. She's written The Watchman's Rattle on today's Topical Currents. We need to take a short break. Please stay with us, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM, NPR for the Florida Keys. The Gold Coast Jazz Society hosts Free Friday Jazz Jams this Friday, December 7th, from 7:30 to 9:30 p.m. at ArtServe, 1350 East Sunrise Boulevard. Young jazz musicians jam with the pros. Details at goldcoastjazz.org. SHINE is a program that helps seniors understand their Medicare and health insurance. With large numbers of baby boomers joining the Medicare ranks daily, SHINE needs volunteers. Learn more about becoming a SHINE volunteer at floridashine.org or call 1-800-96-ELDER.
You can kick off your holidays early in Key West as the island comes alive with the holiday spirit. At kwholidays.com, you'll find many holiday events. The Key West Harbor Walk of Lights brings the waterfront alive every evening with the sparkle of holiday lights on the water. You can tour Victorian guesthouses with their holiday decorations in full bloom on the Key West Holiday Historic Inn Tour. kwholidays.com for up-to-date details on all the holiday events in Key West. Brought to you by the Monroe County Tourist Development Council. Chapman Partnership provides more than just food and shelter for the homeless. They are committed to making the homeless whole again. From treatment for medical, dental, and mental health issues to vocational training to child care and housing placement, Chapman Partnership guides the homeless from hopelessness to self-sufficiency, having served over 90,000 people with a success rate upwards of 62%. You can help the homeless with your support for Chapman Partnership. Details at 877-548-6369 or chapmanpartnership.org.
And it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. And we resume our conversation with Rebecca Costa. Rebecca, how about a website where people can learn more about you and the book?
The website is my name, RebeccaCosta.com, and the book's available in all airport bookstores and online retailers of every bookstore across the country.
And our telephone number, if you'd like to join in the conversation, you're certainly welcome. That number is 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN, and also email, it's radio@WLRN.org. Rebecca, I suppose you're sort of a colleague. You have a radio program that airs in several stations in California and Washington. Tell us about that venture.
Well, since I know that the second stage in the collapse of any organization or civilization is that there's a confusion over what are facts and what are unproven beliefs. And by unproven beliefs, I don't mean religious beliefs. I mean anything that's not empirically based. For example, you put your money in the bank and you expect it to be there. And one day you may write a check and it may not be there. It's just a belief that you have. And humans need belief to just function in society. There's nothing wrong with belief. It's when the facts are pushed aside, and we have a clear case of that, for example, in climate change. We now have 1.5 billion with a B readings of the Earth's surface temperature in all areas of the Earth. And we now know the temperature is going up, but you'll still hear people arguing that there is no global warming. I think what they mean to say is they don't believe that humans are responsible for global warming, but that's different from denying a fact that's been empirically proven. I don't know, maybe they need 2 or 3 billion temperature readings. I don't. 1.5 billion is plenty for me to know that we're going through climate change. We don't need to wait till it's on our door. The problem with problems that we face today is that they can't be stopped in a moment's notice, and they have to be dealt with over a long, prolonged period of time, or the final correction is rather radical and very, very painful. So we were talking about mitigation earlier. One way to look at mitigation is if you effectively mitigate the problem over a long course of time, the final correction is rather minor and painless. It's when you don't mitigate effectively that the correction will bring down a society and cause it to form into smaller groups. No matter where you go in this country, people are overwhelmed. Our leaders are overwhelmed. Eric Schmidt, the president and CEO of Google, says that we generate enough data every 24 hours, every 2 days, as we did from the dawn of humankind to year 2003. Is there any question that humans are struggling adapting with that? And if we're struggling, so are our leaders. It comes as no surprise to me that a communication from Benghazi, which could have saved 4 American lives, didn't get into the right hands. Is there any question in everyone's mind how many communications from embassies around the world are coming into the State Department? There is no one to blame here. There is no one to hang out to dry.
So what are you saying in relation to that?
I'm saying that we have got to deal with an organic problem, that the history of collapse is the history of humans failing to adapt to their environment. And our environment right now is complexity. So one of the things that we've got to do is we've got to face the fact that our brains are falling behind, not just your and mine, but our leaders as well. We have to find ways to use neuroscience. Think about it. It's the only time that we've been able to look under the skull and see what the human brain is doing when it has too much content to sort through and has to deal with complex problems that it wasn't designed to deal with. And we now have tools that allow us to load content better and make better decisions in a complex, high failure rate environment. An example of that is, and I don't have any association with this company, but Michael Merznick at UCSF Medical Center, he's a famous neuroscientist that did the original work in brain plasticity. And he's designed tools to help you warm your brain up in the morning so that you can load content. And it's very important that people use these tools. It's a little video game you play for 15 minutes, and they've now given it to schools across the country and monitored these children for 3 to 5 years, and they now have 3 times the academic performance of other children with no other changes, no changes in textbook, no changes in teachers, classrooms, computers, nothing else. More importantly, they've given them to senior citizens, and they've seen a radical reduction in auto accidents because it fine-tunes peripheral vision. So in these retirement centers where they're just having them play this video game before they go out and conduct their activities for the day, they're discovering if you warm up people's peripheral vision, they get into fewer car accidents. So now even insurance companies are looking at having people log on and use this tool to warm themselves up, and they'll give you an insurance discount.
What was the name of that professor and the video for those who want to look it up?
Yeah.
His name is Michael Merznick, Merznich, and the company's name is Posit Science, POSIT. You can get the game for free. It warms your brain up. Think about your brain. It's an organic part of your body. It's a piece of meat in a skull. It wants to be warmed up before you start your day. Just like you wouldn't go run a marathon if you didn't stretch and hydrate and work out. Unless you wanted a heart attack, you wouldn't do that. You don't want to try to tackle very difficult problems or learn new things without warming your brain up. To me, it is child abuse not to have this in every school. Because if you and I as adults are struggling, what do you think it's like being a 9 and 10-year-old today?
Well, aren't their brains more facile?
Evolution takes millions and millions of years. They're facile, but there's not a significant change between ourselves and our children and our grandchildren. It just doesn't work that quickly. And they need all the help they can get. Being a 9 and 10-year-old in today's civilization is very rough. If I can't figure out how to manage my own money, what advice can I give younger kids?
We have an emailer. Jerry would like to know if you're familiar with Morris Berman's book, How America Failed.
No, I'm sorry, I'm not.
Okay.
I'm not, and I'm a prolific reader, but I just wrote that down. Thank you for the tip.
All right, it's Morris Berman, How America Failed.
Again, our telephone number, if you'd like to join in, that's 1-800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576. Also, email radio@wlrn.org.
Rebecca, I'd like to turn our focus now to one of the things you focus on, which is the 5 super memes that you claim to feed humans even before they engage in solving a problem. And I think we should begin by defining a meme and why you've targeted these 5.
A meme is basically a universal thought or behavior. And in a complex environment, we can see that humans react to complexity in sometimes unconstructive ways. And I identify in the book, the book's divided into 3 sections. The first third, I go through the Mayan history, the Roman history, you know, and I try to show what the earliest signs that they were headed for collapse were. Because again, I'm interested in the early signs when there's time to take painless action in order to change the course of humanity, not when it's, you know, pants on fire time. And you have to do something that's going to be very ugly for humanity. But, you know, it's not that unusual. I just want to go back to evolution again. We're designed for fight or flight. We're not really designed to have any physiological reaction to long-term threats, which is one of the things we have working against us. If I throw a snake in the room, everybody knows to run or kill the snake. But you put somebody in a room and you show them 1.5 billion readings that the Earth's temperature is going up, and their heartbeat doesn't even go up 1 an hour. So we have that going against us as a biological phenomenon, that even though a long-term danger may be more threatening to us, we don't physiologically respond. We have to make things a snake in the room. Going back to these reactions that people have, these days we have 5 major responses to complexity. The first is irrational opposition. We begin opposing everything and confusing opposition with advocacy. We think if we turn down everybody's ideas and we say no, 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 and find out what's wrong with it, that we're advocating a position, and nothing could be further from the truth. The best example we see of this is in Washington, D.C. right now. You know, the Republicans are not wrong 100% of the time, and the Democrats are not wrong 100% of the time. And yet, if you look at their voting records, anything the Democrats put up, the Republicans say no. And anything the Republicans put up, the Democrats say no. And we know, standing back, that that's an irrational position. And it's just sending us over the cliff. And yet, you would think that they seem helpless to be able to reach any kind of reasonable compromise. And we may very well have to go off that cliff for people to come to their senses. And then there are other memes which take hold in a complex environment. The personalization of blame. Again, I use the Benghazi example. But I use other examples of going after the heads of the automakers for the failure of an entire industry. I don't know if people remember this, but when they went to Congress to ask for bailout money, one of the senators asked a question how they got there, and they all said they flew in on planes. And the next day, the only thing anybody in the media could talk about is, how dare they flew in and on private planes to ask the American taxpayer for money? You know, it had nothing to do with the fact the entire automobile industry was collapsing, but we got all sidetracked and all huffy about that. Very interesting that when it comes to complex systemic problems, we tend to go after people as though we're a lynch mob in the Wild West storming the jail and want to pull someone out and hang them, as if that will solve our problems. And then there are other super memes as well, counterfeit correlation, silo thinking, and then also extreme economics. We seem to think that every problem we have is an economic one, and therefore every solution to everything that we suffer from has to be economic in origin.
We are speaking with Rebecca Costa. We're talking about her book, The Watchman's Rattle. We're going to take another short break and be back with more. This is Topical Currents.
And this is 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and NPR for the Florida Keys, 91.5 WKWM. Join us on WLRN TV 17 for John Sebastian Presents Folk Rewind. The show, hosted by the lead singer of The Love and Spoonful, features Pete Seeger, Judy Collins, and other folk-era legends. That's John Sebastian Folk Rewind on Thursday, December 6th at 8 p.m. on WLRN Channel 17. We're funded by listeners like you and by Fair to Remember, a full-service off-premise catering company committed to making your event memorable anywhere in South Florida. Details on scheduling your event at 786-250-5387 and online at fairtoremember.com.
We're funded by listeners like you and by U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. Learn how memory has the power to change the world at a free public event on December 9th in Boca Raton, marking the museum's 20th anniversary. It's also an opportunity to honor local Holocaust survivors and World War II veterans. Details at ushmm.org/neveragain and at 866-99-USHMM.
The Legend of Zelda: Symphony of the Goddesses brings what may be the world's most popular video game series to life with a full symphony orchestra and a massive video screen on stage. You can witness 25 years of Zelda game history unfolding, complete with a cinematic video presentation synced to picture with the game's thematic and action-packed music, all performed live, December 9th at the Adrian Arts Center. Information at artscenter.org.
And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman here with Joseph Cooper. And we're visiting with Rebecca Costa. She's a sociobiologist. She's written The Watchman's Rattle, Thinking Our Way Out of Extinction. And we have some emails and some calls. Rebecca, Joe wants to know, are not politics driven by sociobiological forces? Put another way, why does she imagine all groups will see their interests as united rather than in competition, as in nature?
Well, humans have a schizophrenic nature. Part of us competes, as in Darwin. You know, we're all competing to propagate our DNA. But we also equally have a very long tradition of collaboration in the face of danger. We collaborated against enemies and that were predators that were much larger than ourselves, and in that way we're able to protect ourselves. We caught larger prey, and we were able to provide better food to our groups and allow our groups to get larger.
Right.
So there's a long history of collaboration, and we are genetically bred to be natural-born collaborators and to be troop-dwelling organisms, not lone wolves, as we've economically set it up to be. I mean, I have a friend now who says, well, the way that we've set our economic system up is that, you know, you don't need your troop. You can buy everything on the internet, not even leave your house. You can have your groceries brought, your food. You could even buy affection on the internet. So we may be drifting from being a troop dwelling or a collaborating creature, and that could happen. But from a genetic standpoint, once again, the clock of evolution is slow. That would take many, many, many millions of years. So like I said, we're a bit schizophrenic about it, but in the face of danger, in the face of large problems, we do better when we collaborate. There's no argument about that historically.
I think the notion of private property is probably less than 10,000 years old on the big scale. That really isn't that long. Hello, Ms. Costa.
Yes, we got a little glitch there.
Okay. Well, let's take a call or two. We've got John. He's in Fort Lauderdale. Thanks for your patience, John. Hi.
Hi. thank you for taking my call. I'm really, I think, calling to support Ms. Costa and give some very specific examples. I'm an older caller. We had a president that said drop the bomb. His name was Truman. We had another president who said we will put a man on the moon in 10 years. His name was Kennedy. We had a consumer advocate by the name of Ralph Nader who revolutionized pushing the federal government to even put seatbelts in automobiles and get emissions under control. We had Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill, different parties, but they compromised and they got work done for the people. My point is this. Today, as Ms. Costa just recently said, the Republicans are right 100% of the time and the Democrats are right 100% of the time. If government really wanted to do something, and I'll give you a specific example, I don't want to be long-winded, but if they really wanted to revolutionize energy supply in this country, they would mandate that utility companies that enjoy monopolies in this country in 10 years take their right-of-ways that they own underneath high-tension lines and install solar and wind generation power. And if they wanted federal funding or federal tax exemption for this type of project, it must be made in America and installed by Americans. What we need today are more statesmen, which we lost years ago, and less politicians. Thank you for listening to my comments, and I'll take anything you want to say offline.
Thank you.
Any comments?
Okay, well, I want to commend the caller because I think he's got exactly the right idea of what we need to be doing. Let me say this. I wrote this book because I spent 25 years in Silicon Valley, and there is no question in my mind we have the technology and we have the human knowledge to solve every single catastrophic problem that humankind faces today. And again, I started this program by saying every nation's got the same list of problems they're dealing with, so this is a species-wide issue. I do have to say that if we've got the technology, if we've got the knowledge, right, think about this, millions of years of knowledge accumulated, and we're not acting on it, then what is the problem? And I think we have to go back to our genetic inheritance to find out why we're behaving no better than the Mayan leaders, no better than the Roman leaders, who knew that they could no longer pay their armies to defend Rome, who knew they were getting into debt. We're going down these same paths, and when humans act irrationally, I promise you there is a genetic basis to it. So we have got to go back to our genetic origins and understand where that irrational behavior comes from. Now, the second point that he made is that why is this going on in Washington, D.C., and more importantly, why are we as a people in the United States putting up with it? And I will say this. There are people that are capable of compromise. There are very few amongst us, but there is such a thing as a benevolent leader. There truly is. And there comes a time when we will have to decide. We will either follow a false prophet, as in the days of Hitler, because we are confused about what the facts are and what the beliefs are, or a benevolent leader will rise to the forefront. And we must put systems into place to allow that benevolent leader to lead us.
And
it's very important that we are susceptible at this point in time. People need to understand this. Mm-hmm.
And we'll move along to another caller. This is Richard in Weston.
Yeah, I have 2 points. How much religion are you putting into your stuff? And, you know, and I must say, I mean, and I don't mean this in any offense, but you sound kind of extremist on the phone or on the radio. Have you gotten that before? And I will take my answers off the air. Thank you.
I don't have any particular religious belief I advocate at all. Religion to me is an unproven belief, but as a scientist, I deal with things that are unproven all the time. That doesn't mean they're wrong or they're right. So when I encounter atheists who believe it to be a bad thing that humans have beliefs, I ask them, what human group can you ever point to that doesn't have beliefs? Scientists have beliefs. We just call them hypotheses. What do you think a hypothesis is? It's a belief. So immediately I find that whenever you use the word evolution, immediately the word religion seems to come with it. There's nothing controversial about evolution at all, and there's really nothing controversial about religious beliefs. We've had beliefs going back to the times we lived in caves. We drew little pictures to help us catch larger prey, to make women more fertile. The history of human beings is a history of the vigorous pursuit of knowledge and facts, along with an accommodation for where facts dropped off, and we had nothing else to lean on but our beliefs. So, no, I don't come from any religious area. And in terms of my enthusiasm, if I sound like an extremist, I hope you won't write me off because of that. I'm Italian. Sometimes us Italians, we get worked up and we sound like extremists.
Let's just say you're passionate.
I'm passionate. Yes, I am.
Okay, there we go.
Rebecca, we have another emailer. She or he, Martin, wants to know if you're familiar with spiral dynamics and the development of memes.
Yes, I am. I am aware. I call these super memes. Memes in and of themselves, I don't believe, are harmful to a society. Generalized beliefs or viral beliefs are, they can be pointed to, as I mentioned before, in every society. What super memes are dangerous because they have the side effect of quashing empirical data from coming forward. An example would be, it happens to be a religious example, but the Crusades. The Crusades, during that time, those religious beliefs took over every aspect of human life in those areas where the Crusades affected it. And so there was no vigorous pursuit of empirical fact. We can see, if we study the early development of societies, that there is a very a compassionate accommodation for the pursuit of empirical facts as well as beliefs. We can see that during those periods of time, those societies thrive, but it's when the beliefs overtake the pursuit of facts that they begin to head toward collapse.
I'm thinking now, even when it comes to global warming, I mean, we interviewed an author once recently, Science Left Behind, saying that everybody on the left, that those on the left don't get the bad press those on the right get, but that, you know, a lot of what we're calling facts are beliefs. I mean, how do you distinguish when it can be subjective? A lot of those that say that science is based on beliefs and not facts.
Well, you bring a good point, because for every study you find on the internet, you'll find 10 that contradict it.
Exactly.
So in a time like this, we can say that we're in the second stage of human development. Remember, the first stage is gridlock. You know what the problems are. You have the ability to fix them, but you can't act on them. You become unable to act on them. And the second is that there's a mass confusion where beliefs and facts become substituted. And the third is policy becomes irrational because it's no longer based on rational facts. Let me give an example of the Mayan culture, because I think it speaks well to climate change people who are having trouble having an argument with someone who doesn't believe there's any global warming. And, you know, these arguments, they get very passionate and they get very irrational very quickly.
Right.
So let me use the Mayans as an example. For 3,000 years, they're struggling with water. The first 1,000, 2,000 years, you see them building massive reservoirs. Most people go to see the Mayan temples. Forget that. They were major, they made major advances in hydraulic engineering. They built unprecedented reservoirs, dug underground cisterns to keep the water from evaporating, and also they built the first refrigeration units. They put food down there in times of food scarcity so that it wouldn't spoil. They practiced crop rotation, water conservation. Amazing measures were made, but as the drought persisted and they didn't understand climate change, they began shifting more and more toward fetishism. And during the last 1,000 years, you can see they made no rational man-made measures to conserve water whatsoever, but they just escalated fetishism. In other words, their beliefs in the beginning of the Mayan civilization accommodated rational man-made solutions. But as they begin descending into collapse, you find that they captured slaves, then they moved on to young virgins, And at the very end, prior to the Mayan collapse, they were murdering newborn, unspoiled infants as a solution to their drought and doing nothing else. Now, a lot of people say to me, well, we're not doing that. We're not murdering babies as a solution to climate change. And I said, no, but we do other things. Like we fly, not we as in the United States, but we as a species, we think flying airplanes into buildings is some solution to a rational problem. And we have made that turn. And if I sound like I'm pretty heated up about this, there's evidence of us following irrational solutions everywhere. Just open up the newspaper and you can see it. And we know we're doing it in our own lives. When we're honest about it, we know that there are so many decisions we're having to make about our own health care, about our own finances, about our own vehicles that we don't really understand.
We're speaking with Rebecca Costa. She's written The Watchman's Rattle on today's topical currents. We'll take more of your calls and your emails after this break. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to Topical Currents on South Florida's NPR News Station 91.3 WLRN and NPR for the Florida Keys 91.5 WKWM. Community Smiles is a nonprofit dental clinic for uninsured, low-income children and families. Donations from the community allow them to provide comprehensive dental care. Details at communitysmiles.org, creating smiles since 1946. We're funded by listeners like you and by Art Miami and the inaugural Context Art Miami Fairs, December 4th through the 9th. 190 international galleries offering cutting-edge, modern and contemporary art and curated indoor and outdoor projects. Details at artmiami.com.
Hello, I'm Renee Montaigne of NPR News. WLRN counts on listener support to pay for the news. You can help by making a contribution when the WLRN Fund Drive begins this Wednesday morning at 7. There will be only 3 hours of fundraising for the day. After 10 a.m., the rest of the day will be fundraising free. So please help WLRN bring you more news with as little on-air fundraising as possible. Give Wednesday morning, and please give as generously as you can. Thank you.
What may be South Florida's most beloved holiday tradition returns December 8th through the 18th with Seraphic Fire's Grammy-nominated Candlelight Christmas Concerts. Timeless carols and beautiful Gregorian chant combine into a concert experience the Miami Herald calls gorgeous and evocative. There are performances across South Florida. Two concerts are already sold out. Tickets at 305-285-9060 or seraphicfire.org.
And it is today's topical currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman, and we're speaking with Rebecca Costa about her book, The Watchman's Rattle. Rebecca, we've had some callers who'd like you to repeat the brain warm-up program information.
Yeah, that would be Posit Science, P-O-S-I-T. And I'd like to talk about that for just a moment.
You said it was UCF. Is that University of California at Fresno? Or
at San Francisco. San Francisco. The doctor's name is Michael Merznick, M-E-R-Z-N-I-C-H. And he has what's called brain fitness tools. You can try them out online. I have no affiliation with the company whatsoever. But you can try them on. You know, look, we're all struggling. We're all overwhelmed with data. We don't know how to separate facts from beliefs and opinions. Many of us are going into the voting booth, and all we've heard are commercials. I mean, when we're really honest about it, all we've heard are commercials and watched a couple of debates. It's very hard to get down to what the facts are. And, you know, this last election, I watched MSNBC, CNN, and Fox News because I have a radio program of my own, and I don't want to report anything that's a belief to the public. And I watched all three of those the programs, and they all had people called fact-checkers on them. And all three fact-checkers had different facts. So if somebody whose job it is to be a fact-checker has a different fact, then, you know, you and I, the man on the street, we've got nothing to be ashamed of. We have got to admit we are overwhelmed. And I want our leaders to admit that when someone like Nancy Pelosi puts her hand on the health care bill and says, boy, I'm really glad we passed it, so now we can read it. Do we need any more evidence that we have met our match from a cognitive standpoint? The failures we're having today are failures of complexity versus the human, the capabilities we've evolved to this point in time. That's why we're failing. It's nobody's fault. It's not a political issue, and it certainly isn't an economic issue.
Joanna wants to know how the average American can counteract normalized cultural ignorance on a large scale.
It's very difficult because when you're dealing with ignorance, it's always going to stoop to an irrational argument. And you can't win on that. So if you do run into somebody, like on an argument like climate change, or you're a Democrat and you're talking to a Republican or vice versa, and you can see there's a lot of passion there, the only thing you can hope to counteract that with is facts. Don't get into an irrational argument. Don't give up. Give the person data, because we are a data-seeking organism. That's why we've risen to the top of the food chain. It's our greatest evolutionary inheritance, our ability to think rationally. And so eventually that will kick in. So I don't engage people irrationally. I'm passionate, but I never stop giving them data. That's why I'm on the radio. That's why I have a radio program, because I want people to have the information. And that's why I like radio programs like this one, because you're trying to get the data out and let people make up their own mind.
So what advice would you give to our president?
Well, you know, surprisingly enough, we faced a situation like this back when Eisenhower was president. We had to make some very tough decisions about nuclear weapons. And Eisenhower knew that the generals that he was meeting with, they had other agendas. And he did a very smart thing. He called upon the smartest people in our nation to come and meet with him in a private lunch once a month. And no staff members, no generals, no one else was allowed into it. And he called in physicists. He called in about 12 or 15 of them, and he said, explain to me about nuclear energy. I have to make some decisions about energy, about weapons, and I need to talk to people who are scientists and who have no skin in the game one way or another. And he called it the President's Science Advisory Committee. And it was a great thing that he started. It was then carried on by subsequent presidents, including Kennedy, who had to make decisions. Think about this. In our nation's capital, they're deciding on nuclear energy, and none of them have ever taken a physics class. And I promise you, if they did take one, they didn't pass it. So we have this situation where they're voting on very complex things. But if I had advice to give the president, it would be to call upon the nation's brightest that have no political agenda, meet with them privately, and get the straight scoop about what the facts are. Because the information that is coming into the White House is so contaminated at this point in time. That is the only way to do it. And these people were not paid, by the way. And they didn't want jobs in Washington, D.C. And they didn't have handlers handling publicity. In fact, few people even know who the members of the President's Science Advisory Committee were. But you can look this up. It's a matter of historical record. Unfortunately, Nixon killed the President's Science Advisory Committee. Didn't want that, didn't want any outsiders in there. And then Bush resurrected a form of it, but really it was all people inside the Beltway. So it was unfortunate.
Rebecca, can you give that game and the website and, again, the doctor's name? We're getting more emails for that.
Yes, it is. It's Posit Science, P-O-S as in Sam, I-T, Posit Science. The doctor's name is Dr. Michael Merznick. He did the pioneering work in brain plasticity. That's where when your brain was damaged, it rewires itself to perform certain tasks. The brain is so flexible. Think about this. If you're older, think about this. On your deathbed, a minute before you're ready to pass into another world, you can learn a foreign word. Your brain just keeps on going. There is nothing wrong with the human brain that neuroscience can't help us with right now. But we've got to get this into schools. We've got to get into retirement homes. We've got to help ourselves, because our problems, again, are not economic and political. They're biological. We've met our match in terms of complexity and what the human organism was designed to handle. And I'm telling you, when Verizon comes out and they tell me that I can get a new smartphone with 200,000 apps on it, I'm not designed to handle that. Why do you think we had to make a law to tell people they can't text and drive at the same time?
Rebecca, we're just about out of time. I certainly want to thank you for spending this hour with us. Rebecca Costa, she's the author of The Watchman's Rattle. Have a good day, Rebecca.
Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye, Rebecca.
And that wraps up today's edition. My apologies to those callers we couldn't get on the air. Our producer is Richard Ives, technical direction from Caroline Brader-Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. Follow us on the Topical Currents Facebook page for author and book links, staff photos, discussion, and more. We also have free audio archives and downloads from our website. That's WLRN.org. Tomorrow at 1, it's live coverage of the Miami-Dade County School Board meeting. Thursday, we return with Linda Gastenheimer's Food and Dining and hear her annual Holiday Kitchen Gadget Gift Program. And today's calendar, on this day in 1937, 75 years ago, the birth of Max Baer Jr. in Oakland. Of course, he played the dolt Jethro Bodine on the Beverly Hillbillies. The ultimate victim of typecasting, Baer actually had some good book learning. He minored in philosophy at Santa Clara University. He once dated Sharon Tate. And on this day in 1993, 19 years ago, the death of unclassifiable musician Frank Zappa of prostate cancer. He was of Greek-Arab descent. NPR's late Daniel Shore eulogized at Zappa's funeral. One more while we set the pick and roll. On this day in 1997, 15 years ago, the NBA's Latrell Sprewell is suspended for choking and threatening to kill his coach, P.J. Carlissimo. Sprewell later starred for the Knicks. We leave with a thought from Frank Zappa, who testified before Congress in 1985, deriding Tipper Gore's censorship movement. Quote, "There are more love songs than anything else. If songs could make you do something, we'd all love one another." This is Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation.
This is